and get clear about what we can do so that we're a part of the solution, not part of the problem. There's so much information and static coming at us from all different directions that sometimes we're just plain overwhelmed by it all. If we don't step out of it from time to time to tune into ourselves, then we're just like a cork out at sea, drifting all sorts of different directions. So one of the essential things when this information overload is simply to get quiet a few times a day and listen.
Yeah, beautiful. I would like to share one thing too. It's kind of amazing. Speaks directly to these issues. It was a quote from 1973, Stephen Gaskin, if I may. So it took 400 or 500 years for the Roman Empire to fall, but we have better communication these days. It can happen a lot quicker. And this is a decadent empire. The thing you do about a decadent empire is you don't try to tear it down. You'll get caught underneath it. Just stand back, take care of yourself, learn how to take care of some other people. Don't take over the government. Take over the government's function. Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, that's interesting.
So I thought I'd share that and thank you for the opportunity to talk about these things, and I hope everyone's doing something good about it in their in what they feel so moved to do, from the heart. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night. Well, that's another heartfelt communication. Anyone else, do you feel like calling in and taking your part of the First Amendment? 464-8295. 464-8295. So I started to go into this article about the psychology of fanaticism. And she was kind of looking at this almost insane drive to attack another country on very faulty evidence and trying to understand the mindset that would do such a thing. And so she consulted a couple psychiatrists and to get a better understanding, as she says, of the fanatical mindset that's driving the Bush administration agenda and scaring the living daylights out of a growing number of us. And so she talked to the different professors at the University of Toronto and so forth, and they started to talk about the characteristics of fanaticism, an intolerance of dissent, a doctrine that is riddled with the contradiction, belief that God is on your side and you're an agent of God, and the cause is good, but it is the only good, the absolute good. Or as President Bush famously declared, "I'm here. There's no in-between as far as I'm concerned. Either you're with us or you're against us." Pretty much a strong statement on themselves. I think it's a pretty good question to ask. I think people perhaps like her really don't understand there's another dimension. I don't think the Bush administration are fanatics in that regard. I think they're sick, but the disease is not fanaticism. I think it just comes down to this thing called power, greed, and ego, and a little bit of money thrown in. They all work for PG&E, power, greed, and ego. And when you have billions at your disposal, which the Bush family does, by the way, there's if you really want to find out what's going on with the Bush family, go to Skolnick's website. He's on the web, and he has a whole long series of articles on the what he calls the Bush crime family, and it's quite an extensive revealing of the all the interlocking devices and enterprises the Bush family's been involved in for decades. It really goes back quite some time. So there's a much deeper dimension here than mere fanaticism on the part of Bush and the administration. I wish I could just pass it off as them being a little bit crazy and out of their mind, but there's, as I say, Bush and his pile of friends there are really not at the top of the heap in terms of what's coming down in this country or directing what's going on with this country. They're up there fairly high, but there's people above them that are actually giving orders and directions and steering the way things are going. Well, next week we'll be talking about computerized voting machines and what a danger they represent. So this is Tom Clooney, and I'll see you next week. Thank you very much. Well, it was a great show on the KSC.
I'm going to take off for a time.
Yeah, it does. For a while there. Glad to help you out anyway.
Well, I appreciate it. So keep the thing going. I said we'll try to keep the thing going.
Sounds good. And I'll see you next Saturday if you have feelings that maybe we could contact
one
to do a 3-hour thing on the Constitution. Do you want me to give him a call?
Well, do you think he would do it? Can we give us the time?
I'll put the idea to what happens.
Okay. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and views of our callers. Now, we're hoping to have Bill Sardi on the line very, very shortly. I think my producer's trying to get Joel Skousen, but why don't we try Bill Sardi? He's supposed to be on at 8 o'clock. And so let's just give Bill a call and see if we get him on. And then we will hope we can get hooked up to our affiliate up in the Great Northwest. So I'm going to just play a little music here for a moment, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and with us right now from Southern California is Bill Sardi. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Great to be with you.
And, of course, Bill is a health journalist, and he studies in health matters, and is certainly one of the most knowledgeable people I know about the myriad of alternative health care measures that are out there that really can be helpful to people with many different types of diseases. And perhaps we'll get around to talking about some of that later on this evening. But I thought perhaps right now we would talk about the dilemma that is facing both our country and Europe. And, of course, in Europe, they have even a worse time than we do. Their birth rate is down. Their population is aging. They've actually come up with a utopian system where everybody's going to be able to retire 55, 60 years at the oldest, and just be taken care of by the government for the rest of their lives. The only problem is there isn't enough money to do it. Right now, they have two workers working for every one person retired who's getting a 70 to 90% of their regular salary. And the people who are working are having to pay for the people who are retired. Now, they're talking about having to make some dramatic changes over there in every aspect of this so-called socialist utopia they have all throughout Europe. And they're simply going to have to begin getting people working for longer hours, for less money, And, of course, they're talking about having to raise the age of retirement in Europe. And then, of course, what about the United States? Well, Bill, why don't you pick up the story from there?
Well, of course, this isn't just a phenomenon in Germany. They're just getting it first, and we also see it in Britain, where workers there have been told to, quote, work until 70 or face a poverty-ridden retirement. And, of course, where are we going to go here? What is the big factor they're pointing out? This was the article in the New York Times you're referring to, and the crucial factor is age. The Europeans are not having babies. There's a stagnant population. And you have to have the babies, the young people, to feed into the Ponzi scheme called Social Security all over the world. Young people, it's a pay-as-you-go system. I know a lot of people feel, well, my money's in there and they're going to give it back to me plus. That isn't true. The young just hand it to the old, and there have to be enough young people around to fund these Ponzi schemes. And the problem is a stagnant population growth in Europe. While you see here in the United States, they're allowing lots of immigrants in, young people from Mexico and so on. And you really have to believe they're doing this in an effort to try to stabilize the Social Security system, because we do have a rather fragile system. If we can't get our economy to grow at a certain rate, then we have to find more young people to pay into the system. It's that simple. And, of course, we do have a desirable country where people want to come. And, of course, that can push a lot of young workers in here who then will pay Social Security and pay for the older people and take a little bit of the pressure off. But as you notice, there's lots of other pressures going on. After all, our dollar has gone down in value. Our unemployment has gone up. And if our unemployment goes up, that's less people to pay into the system to make sure that it doesn't go insolvent. And so anybody has any illusion, there really is no money in Social Security. It's just an IOU sitting there.
And, you know, for years, anybody who said that there was no money in the Social Security system has been ridiculed and demonized. I'll never forget when Pat Robertson was running for president, and he was talking about that. And they said, of course there's money there. Why, you know, of course, there are these receipts for this money, and it's right there. But what are the receipts for? Well, it says the government will fund it. But where has the government got to get the money? The government doesn't have any money. The only money it has is what it takes from us by force, what it, of course, can borrow from future generations, or what it can print and create inflation and destroy the value of the currency. So, you know, the idea that there is money in this Social Security fund is a lie. And as I was mentioning to you off the air, Pete Peterson is one of the names that everybody should know, but most people have never heard of him. He was, of course, for 10 years the CEO of Lehman Brothers. He was the director of the Council on Foreign Relations. I think he was the chairman and me for a number of years. Now he's with the Blackstone Group, but one of the most wealthy and powerful men in the world. And recently he was on CNN or on C-SPAN. And, of course, he was being interviewed and saying, there is no money in Social Security. And, of course, Americans are going to have to accept the fact that they're going to have to retire later, and they're going to get less money and during their periods of retirement. So this is coming down the line, and I almost think that this is happening at this time while we're distracted by what's happening over in Iraq and really by many other things, so that the average individual will not realize what's happening, or certainly will be so distracted he won't be able to vent his fury on the politicians who've lied to us for years and spent our money. And, of course, the great tragedy is we hear about, you know, of course, isn't this wonderful? We have this great new system of taxes, this tax cut, so fewer and fewer people are going to have to pay income taxes. But what they don't tell you is that every one of the people in America pays a 15% tax to the government through Social Security, 7.5% of their own, 7.5% from their employer. And that money, it doesn't go into a fund. They simply spend it. It's a hidden tax, and they don't want the American people to know that they're being taxed in that manner.
Well, this is true. You know, like I said, the dollar has lost value. The unemployment is up. We have lost a staggering $2.8 trillion in pension funds worldwide that were invested in stock markets. That is 21% of their value. So combine all those factors together to see where it's going. And now As you can see, retirees have the little bit of money they have in the bank because they've retreated from the stock market, and you're putting it into a bank fund that, on a passbook account, that's only getting 1 or 2% at best. So you're losing money in some of these accounts, and now some of the mutual funds are beginning to teeter and actually lose a little bit of money or not return as they have. So some people who have augmented income in addition to Social Security or private funds are finding the rest of their income dribbling down. And, of course, where do we get all the money to do this? Where does money come from? Obviously, we don't understand it completely. Some of it's printing presses, and some of it is borrowed. And it's quite striking because I have the New York Times article in front of me of February 6th of this year, said there was a warning on our debt ceiling hitting $6.4 trillion. That was in February of this year. What is it now in June 28th? $7.384 trillion. $6.4 to almost $7.4 trillion in just a few months. We've gone up $1 trillion in not even a year. This is going crazy. We're borrowing money. And that's the whole question. What if the world that lends us money, because we have to get, we consume goods in the world and we send our money overseas and we buy goods at a wonderful price from China, Mexico, Thailand, and wherever. But then they have our money and they lend it back to us. And what if there is a stop or some sort of a pause in the ability to get money borrowed in here so that we can then raise our debt ceiling and pay all these bills? And if any world downturn in economy occurs, or there's a call on any of these, on this money, then of course we're really going to be in trouble. We really rely on the rest of the world to loan us money back to keep our economy going. In other words, all of us in total have a giant credit card. We're loaning money to keep our own government going from these other countries. We are in no way fiscally solvent. This is what we're doing. WorldNet Daily pointed out just this month that our real debts, they say our debts are around $3 trillion, but when you look at all the uncovered debts, that is the ones that are projected that we have obligated funds that we need to pay out, it really turns out with Social Security, Medicare, that we haven't figured out how to cover yet, now and in the near future, totals about $43 trillion. Now, usually when you have a debt like that, let's say you do, then you balance it against collateral. In this case, let's just say against our debts, we have all the value of U.S. households in the United States, which is only about $40.6 trillion. So you see, we're beyond, we don't have the collateral to cover our debts from household, you know, the property values and so on. So we're $40.6 trillion collateral, $43 trillion projected debt. So they're really covering the real whole thing. Now, if you took that and you put that out into, I was trying to make some notes on the back of papers here, it was something like $153,000 of debt per person and $300,000 of debt per worker in the United States. So, and so everyone understands the burden of that from a personal income standpoint, not a corporate one, but from a personal income standpoint, the bottom 50% of all the tax forms filed in the United States pay 4% of the taxes. The top 50% pay the other 96% of the taxes. And actually, it's about the top 5 or 10%, somewhere in that range, that pay about 70% of the personal income taxes in the United States. So while they say the rich are getting richer, it's true. But then, of course, they pay the greater part of the taxes. We do have a progressive income tax system. So when we say we want to cut taxes, what they've really done is in the low-income groups, they always argue that there's nothing for the low-income groups in tax. Well, that would have to be a welfare program, not a tax cut, because they pay very little, if any, taxes. And in fact, what Bush did in his first tax cut was give money to people that they never paid in taxes. He didn't give them back money that they paid. He just paid them off, and that made the people at the low end of the scale happy that they got something to spend. And, of course, here we are with the second return, as we've had a tax return. None of us have gotten the checks yet, it's a little tentative, but I wonder how much they're just trying to pay us off, you know, kind of jumpstart the economy and get us to spend it all. Is it real money? We don't have it. We're in debt, and it isn't real money anyway. So how far you can go along like this? You know, you have some people on the Internet who are suggesting that the Second Amendment, which is our right to bear arms, comes in direct conflict with the Social Security, because when the world finds out, when Americans find out that there's no money there for the Social Security, then they predict violent outbreaks. And really, all of these places that government has to go hide, you know, we have all these bunkers and things around the country where our leaders can run and hide. Well, that isn't just necessarily due to incoming missiles being fired here from China or Russia. Some people think that's all there when Social Security collapses and they can't control the population and they have to run somewhere to maintain control. And, of course, they don't want us to have guns because there'll be a violent backlash. So whether that's really true or not, I don't know. Americans tend not to be that way. But you certainly get older adults today to turn their heads around, and when you say, hey, you may not receive a Social Security check, after all, just so you all understand, unless somebody's raising the debt ceiling by $1 trillion in the last 6 months, you would have not gotten your Social Security check. We would have been bankrupt. That would have been announced. And what would we all have done? We're loaning money and then loaning money on top of loaning money. How far can we go? How far can our leaders go until they tell us the truth? There's no money in the bank accounts. They're just printing it and loaning it. And who knows what the end of all this is? There has to be, we have to pay the piper somewhere here. So this is the situation we're looking at. How long the leaders can hide it from the public is beyond me. I can't understand it. Every time we have an election, the politicians stand up and say, we're going to protect the Social Security trust fund. What trust fund? There's nothing there. We just keep raising the debt ceiling, borrowing money from overseas, and printing money, making our money worth less, diluting the value of our money in order to keep this place going. So just imagine you've got play money and you just keep printing it. It becomes worth less because you can only buy the same amount of things or do the same amount of work. So it becomes a what we call inflation. To counter all this and keep the economy going, we see it going in the opposite. To hang on to business is clawing to stay out of bankruptcy. We see a lot of personal bankruptcies, record personal bankruptcies. But even business is in trouble, and General Motors and Ford and all these companies, you notice they're giving away their cars. You can buy a Ford Mustang, and they give you $5,000 off plus some low-interest loans. It's amazing they're giving away the cars, and why? Because they're having trouble with their pension funds. They're having to refund their pension funds. They used and borrowed the money, these corporations did, just like our government did, and used it to grow their company, and now they've got to pay it back. And so they're just running their companies now to replenish their pension funds rather than to progress and build profits. And, of course, in order to do it, keep the collapse of these companies, they're giving away cars at unheard-of prices, and we call that deflation. So there is the concern with deflation. It's great for consumers. It'll only last a while, and then there'll be massive unemployment as they have to lay off people, and that's when you get the collapse of Social Security and all these other things, and then, of course, the whole thing implodes. So how far can this whole little juggling match go on as we take and twist little plates up in the air, and we've got about 7 or 8 of them in the air right now? Sooner or later, one of them is going to start to wobble, and then the rest will fall. So, someone has said you really can't tell the American public how bad it is. Then it will really get dismal because people won't spend money, people won't go out and do the normal trade and business that they do, and that will make things worse. After all, the mentality of the public is about 13 years old. So, if you start a panic in the population, then you make all these things worse, so we don't tell the people the truth. We just keep hiding it from them, and we keep spinning those plates around until maybe one of them falls and we have to admit it. So how long this is going to go on, I have no idea. Do you, Dr. Sands?
No, I don't think anybody does. I'm constantly amazed at how effective the Federal Reserve System is in manipulating an artificial economy. And I'll never forget back in 1980, 1980, many of the people may remember that the interest rates got up pretty close to 20%. And of course, they did this. They did this intentionally. It was done by the Federal Reserve System so that they could slow the economy down because it had just been overheated. And this is how you slow an economy down. You make just money totally unavailable. Well, because if you have money to loan to the bank at that time, you make out like a bandit. But of course, if you're the average person, you need money to do business. Why? It makes it almost impossible to get. But I marveled at the time at how Paul Volcker, who was the head of the Fed at that time, certainly a Rockefeller employee, formerly head of Chase Manhattan Bank, or worked at Chase Manhattan Bank, was able actually to bring the economy back into balance. We had the Reagan recession about 1982, and then things took off all over again. Now, that's entirely different than the situation we're in right now. We're going to just take a little quick break here because we have to let our listeners up in that great north woods, Eastern Washington, go for a break. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is our guest this evening is Bill Sardi. We're talking about what's happening to the economy. And, of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But something you said earlier, Bill, I thought was really fascinating. You said that you thought maybe they were allowing all this immigration to actually maintain the economy so we would have more people working and, of course, paying into Social Security. And I think you're absolutely right. Why, if you look at things logically, why do you think the Ford Foundation is putting out, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to encourage illegal immigration, setting up funds and organizations for the illegal immigrants like LULAC and MALDAVE, for organizations not for legal immigrants, but for illegal immigrants? Well, because we have to have them coming in. We have to have them coming in to pay into the Social Security system, to provide cheap labor, to make the system continue to work. Now, when you do that, of course, you eventually begin to erode the income of people here who are here legally, of longtime American citizens. But this is part of an organized plan. Why don't they tell us? Because the American people wouldn't like it, because the American people would say, well, gee, the government ought to obey the laws. They can't get Congress to go along with this. The congressman won't vote for open borders, and so they go ahead and they find other means of doing it. And they say, oh, we're trying to control illegal immigration. Look at all the people we have on the border. And then you talk to the people on the Border Patrol, and they're told, you can't go where the people are coming in. You're supposed to sit over here on this hillside where nobody's coming in and let the people come in on a regular basis. Everything is being planned by the elite. And this is what I think people have to know and begin to understand. There are elite people who work behind the scenes who manipulate everything, whether it's immigration, whether it's interest rates, everything that is done to stimulate the economy or dampen the economy down. And all of this, of course, really is mediated through the Federal Reserve System, which is a central bank. It is not a privately owned it is a privately owned bank. It has nothing to do with the federal government. All of this idea that, the federal government, picks the heads of these banks. Well, they're told who they're going to pick. When was the last time you ever heard of anybody being turned down by our government who'd been nominated by the central bankers? And it just doesn't occur. I mean, once they decide who the head of the Federal Reserve is going to be, he is the head of the Federal Reserve. Well, we've got a Jean calling from, is this Jeannie calling from Aptos?
Yes, it is.
Okay, Jeannie, do you have of course, Jeannie had actually seen this interview with Pete Peterson. Do you want to tell our listeners about that?
Oh, right. And I always say, Bill, it's always so good to hear you because you're just a wealth of knowledge because I know you've traveled around the world. And sometimes you don't get it from books. You get your knowledge from talking to people as you travel outside the United States. So thanks for being on this evening,
Bill. Oh, thank you.
This is an amazing clip. It was last Thursday on the Lou Dobbs Show, Moneyline, and Pete Peterson was the guest. and they were talking about Social Security. And Pete Peterson said, well, as you know, the trust fund, there's no trust and there's no funds. He actually said it. And with a straight face.
Yeah, but Gene, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're going to have to bring our listeners on from the Great North, and well, we'll be back here in just a moment. And Pete Peterson is one of the most powerful men in America. You don't hear about him. He's not elected, but he's one of the rulers of our country today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, Jeannie has just called in. Jeannie had actually heard the television program, Pete Peterson on the Lou Dobbs financial program, and so Jeannie was telling us that Pete Peterson had said, right in the camera, there is no trust fund, there is no other, what were the words he said?
He broke it apart. He says there's no trust and there's no funds.
Okay.
In other words, there's no money.
They've been lying to us all these years.
Right. And he said the senior citizens just have to learn to work longer and harder. And so he was very upfront of what was happening, going to happen in the future. I was just given a copy of a interview he did on PBS in 1996, and you can actually get it on the web if you go into pbs.org, NewsHour, and he was interviewed by Gergen, and David Gergen, and he's talking about Social Security in 1996, and here's a quote. Pete Peterson says, we've got to gradually increase the retirement age. I would do it over 20 years, 3 months a year, to give the boomers time.
Now, basically, of course, he had written a book, I think, called The Graying of America at that time.
Uh-huh.
So he's been thinking about this for some time, and he represents what the elite are thinking. But, of course, they've got to gradually sort of spring it on the American people. They can't spring it on a lot at one time.
Well, yeah. Here's the problem, Dr. Stan and Jeannie. In Europe, this is what they're telling us in the New York Times article, across Europe, only 39% of men age 55 to 65 still work. The rest are retiring. They're retiring early. This is the problem. We're here, we're retiring a little bit later than they are in Europe. This is where the crisis is going to come. And these people are not expecting to work, more so than even in this country. And we see, general strikes in Austria, of all places. France, there's been one-day work stoppages. I mean, these are the kind of things, as they're arguing all over this thing, this problem, which they can't quite finger. But this is the problem, and we're going to have to work longer and stay healthier. A legal retirement, what they're suggesting, is an age of 80. Well, of course, what kind of scheme do you have to get to kind of balance the thing? And the Cato Institute says you'd have to hike taxes by 50% or cut the benefits by 25% to keep the system afloat. So one or the other. So obviously they're going to cut the benefits. But here, one thing that dawns upon me really easy to think about is, what if you just trim the size of these people that are getting old? Make sure they don't live as long.
Well, maybe I was thinking about that, Bill.
Maybe you just start a disease. You know, and I mean, here we are back in the news again today saying that, of course, look out because bioterrorists may use the influenza virus as the next terrorist movement. Well, of course this fits politically because if you can just reduce the number of retirees you're putting money out for, there goes the payments for Medicare and Social Security in one swat. And, of course, you've got 40 million retirees or so in the United States, just a 10% reduction with some sort of pandemic that runs around the country. And you knock off 10% of them, there go 4 million, and you save billions and trillions over the next few decades. So,
well, maybe they'd like to give us some... give us some smallpox shots, and that will get rid of a lot of seniors. But I was also looking at, Bill, at a website. It's called network-dot-com. democracy.org. And it's a speech by Peter Peterson. And this is December 4, 1998. And actually, President Clinton was there, and he did the welcome speech. And there were about 50 organizations there regarding Social Security. And this really caught my eye because he's talking about how long we're going to live. And he says we're going to slow down by a 60% on how long we live. And then a parenthesis, he says, short a lifespan brightens Social Security's fiscal outlook.
Doesn't that make you feel good to know that the shorter there's planning on a shorter lifespan for the average American, and that's going to brighten the outlook for Social Security? Now, what's wrong with this picture?
How do you plan for a shorter, a shorter lifespan? Actually, the records are going off the charts. Americans are living longer and longer, particularly people working and staying healthy, not smoking, etc. Good health habits, etc. And of course, one of the things we're doing, which we don't understand, is that the unemployment rates are really much higher than we really think. I have an article here showing we just added 85,000 federal workers.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Bill Sardi, and Jeannie's on the line too. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and, of course, our special guest this evening, Bill Sardi. His website, askbillsardi.com. And Jeannie, of course, Jeannie had some remarks to make, having been observing Pete Peterson, one of that small group of elitists who really runs the country. And if you don't believe we have an elite, a group that really does run things, you're incredibly naive. I would put Pete Peterson into this whole brotherhood of darkness I've written about. One of the elite, of course, establishing this feudalistic system and determining who will live and who will die. Bill, you were coming up with some statistics before I so rudely interrupted.
Oh, no, that's quite all right. I think Jeannie has really helped us focus on, you know, the truth of it all has come out. I mean, she's told us, you know, these people eventually shoot straight and tell us they have to. And you know, is the American public ready for it? I'm not sure. Probably a lot of folks duck their heads. Probably a lot of folks that just get in the motorhome and keep trucking. Government seems to know how to move these figures around. And one of the things you can see here, which I was mentioning, is as unemployment rises, federal government employment will make it up. In other words, as we have unemployment, they just push the unemployed workers over to the federal side and hire them. As people may or may not know, here in California, Gray Davis was elected and made an agreement with a deal with the unions and hired 40,000 workers as part of his deal to get elected. As you can see, that brought $8 billion onto the payroll in the state of California. You notice our state of bankruptcy. He finally conceded and laid off about 8,000 to 10,000 of these workers, but he still got far too many in there, and of course that's the problem when you get these kind of political deals, and then you end up with a declining income, because as the stock market crashed, then the income from taxes into the state crashed, and of course they relied on all that. Just so you all understand, Gray Davis hit the tracks, was elected, and actually gained 25% more money into the income, the coffers at the state, because the state was growing by that much, and he still couldn't keep from bankruptcy, even though he was pulling in 25% more money. So this is the kind of problem you get in spend, spend, and spend. And, of course, we have the added issue of, we talked about it, immigration and so on. And so everyone understands, the poor Mexican people, every time it looks like they're going to get somewhere, if their wages rise up a little bit, they devalue the peso. The government there is in league with, they have to keep the jobs there and keep them from fleeing to Thailand and China and so on. These people make $5 a day. So when it looks like their wages go up, they devalue the peso, and of course the businesses and the giant people who own a lot of money there, they don't keep their money in Mexican banks, keep it in American banks. It doesn't bother them a bit. These people are resigned to being in poverty for the rest of their life. Just imagine the pay increase you got is wiped out by, you know, a devaluation of the dollar here. And so it's not surprising. These people want to get here because this is where you get paid for your work. And by the way, the Republicans get cheap labor, if you want to call them the business owners, and the Democrats get voters because these people come here and they probably largely vote Democratic. So it serves both political forces. And if anybody would like to go to Las Vegas and just see all those hotels and try to figure out where you would find a labor force to clean all those hotel rooms, ladies and gentlemen, it's called immigration. And we allow them across the border in order to do this. So that's simple. We know that we need hundreds and even thousands of maids to work in those hotel rooms, and that's where they dig them up from. And it's a wonderful first step for those people when we're looking at it at a personal level. When we're looking at it at a social level, somebody's having to pay for, of course, the health care for their children, the education for their children. Who's paying for all that? Well, it's really coming off the taxpayers' back. So that's the tough part.
The immigration issue is extremely interesting because you were saying that these immigrants coming across the border, they would actually pay into Social Security. But just think how much money they would borrow from the Federal Reserve. And they
the
need
other
that.
Interesting thing is, of course, that George Bush apparently is negotiating, and I don't know whether it's completed yet or not, with Vicente Fox, but of course, so that we will pay the Social Security to illegal immigrants who come into American work, and we will pay them when they go back to Mexico their Social Security. So
right.
that they will get Social Security from Mexico, they get Social Security from America. Boy, that's a pretty good deal. People come here illegally and pay into Social Security.
Well, I have a feeling that's what's going to happen in Iraq. After all, we're paying a lot of people over there, too. I don't know how far this goes.
Well, of course, apparently, they are actually paying 250,000 people who are in the Iraqi army. Some of them are ready for retirement. Some of them aren't. So they were out demonstrating the streets. So we started paying these members of the Iraqi army, who, of course, were in Saddam's military force. We're now paying them a regular salary. What's wrong with this picture? And there was another fascinating program on this evening, on the evening news. It was talking about overtime. And, of course, they were interviewing teachers who were making about 10% of their income from overtime. And, of course, you take away their overtime, you're going to cut back on their income. But, of course, they were saying that the government is suggesting to employers that you stop paying people an hourly wage. You just give them a regular job, a monthly salary, and then you get them to work overtime for nothing. And, of course, they are on an hourly wage, they have protection by certain laws in the union. When they, of course, are getting a regular salary, they have no protection. And now we're going to see people not getting the overtime, cutting back on their income, cutting back on their living standards. And as we've said so often before, the whole plan, the secret plan, is to gradually raise the living standards of the American to that of the Mexican peasant. We're well on the way. Jeannie, have anything else you want to say?
Well, three issues, just real quick. Unemployment. Reading through some of the documents regarding the monies going down into Central America, our money that we put into the federal government, they are paying unemployment for some of the people in Argentina and other South American countries. So it's not only Social Security, they're starting to do unemployment. I was talking to a man, he says, well, Jeannie, they've been doing that for several years already. Also, if you're an employer and you look at how much Social Security tax goes out, it equals federal tax now. And the third thing, Dr. Stan and Bill, is they are planning a carry tax. And they're feeling that the American people are wondering what's going to happen. And they're holding their dollars back. They're actually their hard cash. And have you heard about that, Bill or Dr. Stan, on putting a date on the actual dollar bills? And
I've heard about it. I don't know whether it's happened yet.
No, it hasn't happened, but they're thinking about it very, very strongly.
Basically, they want you to, when you have currency, they want you to spend it.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks very much, Jeannie.
Okay, good evening.
Okay, bye-bye. And Jeannie's always a pleasure to have with us. Well, Bill, we're sort of, we're doing moving right along here, but I thought this evening I'd like to talk perhaps a little bit about some of the things that you would have to offer our listeners as far as health and health matters are concerned, because I know that's also very, very close to your heart.
Well, of course, I am concerned. I don't like to be a person who's talking about the doom of the world and all those kind of things, but I do like to be alert. I don't like to be naive, and of course, we are aware that government has in their hands many of these weapons of, well, we might call them mass destruction, certainly biological weapons. You and I were talking about a little place called Plum Island, which the government has. It's a little place off the East Coast where, of course, they study animal diseases. And, of course, right across from Plum Island is where, of course, of all things that got started was the Lyme disease. So we wonder if Lyme disease didn't jump from that island where they were studying animal diseases. But of all things, now the Homeland Security Agency is now, of course, department is now going to be in charge of this animal disease center. It doesn't make any sense to me. Well, of course, we have more knowledge about biological warfare than any other country in the world. And, you know, I don't trust anybody with this information. The bad guys aren't necessarily over there. They might be here, and we might use these things for political purposes. We might use it to trim sizes of populations. You've heard me allege before the Darwinists are in charge of the world, survival of the fittest, and damn to you if you live too long, we'll make sure you won't, and maybe you weren't the fittest and you die, you see. So I have said before the initial interest in Radio Liberty was my awareness that humans could live much longer and we weren't. And there must have been controls from somewhere to make sure that we weren't continuing to live even longer, because I was aware there were ways of now doing this and, of course, we weren't utilizing them. So, of course, on my website, I talk about a lot of these things. We talk about things that are certainly avoidable, like autism, on my website at AskBillSardi.com. We talk about everything from cholesterol. There's a three-part report there. Go get it, download it, print it out, and you can learn all about cholesterol and the options, your alternatives from these statin drugs, which are highly toxic to the liver and you shouldn't be taking, and you'll learn some alternatives there to all that. There's no commercials attached to any of that whatsoever. You'll learn about the worldwide fight for vitamins and vitamin supplements, and now coming to a head in England where they're banning 290 different nutritional supplements and putting a limit on the dosage of vitamins and minerals and dietary supplements in the pills themselves. So, and then they're going to try and harmonize the world through trade agreements and limit the amount of vitamins that we can get in vitamin supplements. And why is that important to us? Because, well, frankly, we can duplicate the biological action of virtually every prescription drug with nutritional supplements, herbs, vitamins, minerals, amino acids. They don't want us to find this out. They don't want us to find that we don't have to always go through doctors and pharmacists and all this for the jobs programs that those support, that we can get our health not only from our diet, but from good supplements and things also. And, of course, we don't have to feed the profits of the drug companies. For all of you that are interested, you need to know about natural antibiotics, the oil of oreganos, the garlic extracts, fresh garlic, and olive leaf extracts. Those are the three primary natural agents that we have that are antibiotics. They're both antiviral and antifungal. They get rid of yeast infections, and they do not cause antibiotic resistance like the drugs do. So you need to put those in your kitchen cabinet. We've talked before about the world's first real garlic supplement that has allicin, the real stuff that you find in fresh garlic. You can't find that regardless of what the labeling says on any garlic pill. And, of course, that pill is called Allimax. We've had a lot of requests about that from various sources, and of course a lot of people have called and stocked up on their Allimax and have used it through the winter seasons and so on, and found that it served them well, that they didn't get sick at all. And of course that number for Allimax, 866-405-4000, 866-405-4000, if you want to contact the manufacturer about Allimax. And of course my wonderful new books, I hate to be a book promoter, but many of you people do like books. And, of course, I do have a new book, The New Truth About Vitamins and Minerals. This is the whole story all about, hey, how much vitamin B6 and how much calcium and how much magnesium do you really need iron in your supplements? Are liquid vitamin supplements absorbed better than the ones in the pills? Well, you'll find the truth to all this because you hear a lot of misinformation on the radio these days about these things. Questions about vitamin A, if you get too much, does it weaken the bones? That's not really true, but you probably should get your vitamin A from beta-carotene in food supplements. So all of those questions answered in my new book, The New Truth About Vitamins and Minerals, and then another new wonderful book, The Bible Prescription for Health and Longevity. It's a wonderful book. It tells you why the people in the Bible live so long, not only the hundreds of years, but it talks about why that's really true, the accounts in Genesis and so on, but also why they lived even a 70-year lifespan in the time of King David and achieved a 70-year lifespan 3,000 years before modern man did, and why that was true, and why God had some special provisions for these people from Israel so that they could live so long. And we can learn those same principles and live a long and healthful, productive life. We don't have to be resigned to old age. And while I'm talking about that, my third book is, of course, How to Live 100 Years Without Growing Old. That's all a wonderful story about hyaluronic acid. You might want to read that. You know, I've had the fun of publishing 5 books in 1 year, so some of you folks may want to catch up with that. That's at a website called hereandnowbooks.com, hereandnowbooks.com, and some of you folks may want to read those wonderful books. Or go to my website. All the information is free, including a downloadable book for free called The Collapse of Conventional Medicine. And you can download that book and read it for yourself. We love to give away things for free. And, of course, we've got other reports and things on there about SARS and about AIDS and all these other things that we, of course, love talking about, the natural cures, things that you ought to know. We love to give them away. After all, we can't profiteer off everyone. People are dying. People are suffering needlessly. So get the information. Share it with friends. Light a candle somewhere. Boy, that's a long speech I've had, isn't it?
Well, there's a book you wrote to my some time ago when my wife loves it. It has to do with the Bible and, of course, the history of medicine. What's that book?
That's a wonderful book, and it's really more of an encyclopedic book. It's a big 8.5 by 11 format size, and it's the history of medicine and healing since our beginning time and what actually happened as the first hospitals, the first medicines, the first herbal drugs. The Egyptians, the Babylonians, and on through to Bible medicine. And then, of course, all the healings that were involved in the Bible days. This book is called The Power of Healing, The Power of God. And that book goes through each of the miraculous healings in the Old Testament, the New Testament, and what we call the apostolic era, the era of the apostles. And it explains that all of those were true. They've never been proven to be false. They can't be explained away by anything we know in modern medicine. And some of those miracles were natural healings, and some of them were supernatural healings. And of course, that leads us to a blend of wonderful things when we come to realize that God uses both natural and supernatural ways to keep us healthy. And we shouldn't discard the natural ones. After all, it's real apparent to us that if we cut our hand, that God has a mechanism to heal that cut on our hand without us even thinking about. So there is a self-healing process. We're thankful for God to make us the way he did. And, of course, there's a way to tap into that and make it work even better for us and understand it. And there are natural remedies that God made, all these wonderful molecules. We need to know how to use them. They'll save us a lot of money and a lot of grief and keep us from side effects if we learn how to do those things. So, and, of course, we need to be careful in this day and age. I was just watching television and seeing another, what I call the fake healers, not faith healers, but fake healers on television, and there's some in Christianity. And we need to be aware of that, be aware that God does heal, but maybe not necessarily through every stage preacher that gets up there. So we certainly want to avail ourselves of God's healing. It comes to us in many ways. Some of it is through knowledge, and some of it is through God's power, and of course we need to tap into that and be aware of what's false and what's true, and of course that's what my book is all about. And then we get into the modern age of of medicine and how we've really replaced God with doctors. And we took the Holy of Holies, the cleanest place in the Jewish religion, and then in modern day age, why we made that the surgery suite, and we had the priest in the robe, and then we had the surgeon in his sterile gown, and so on and so on. So the comparison has been made where man has begun to put his faith falsely in something that's only temporary, which is medicine, instead of God, who's eternal. And so that change was made, and for many of us, we bought into that. I love our doctors. I'm glad we have them. I'm glad we have modern medicine. And if I end up in a car accident, I certainly want to avail myself of all the wonderful things of modern medicine. I was part of it for a while. But I do want to say that that isn't going to solve our problems. It's going to help us live longer. We have to stay healthier. And I guess, as we started the show, keep Social Security from going bankrupt. And if you want to do that, you need to learn about vitamins, minerals. A great multivitamin would go a long way to keeping most people healthy. Probably the best anti-aging pill that we've got going, and we're not availing ourselves of it. Instead, we're listening about false cures like sea silver and coral calcium, which the Federal Trade Commission has now stopped the sale of those bogus products. So, you know, we need to learn. I hate to say anything negative about anybody else's products, but, you know, we need to learn. Start with multivitamins. Get the essential vitamins and minerals covered. Get some essential oils from flax or fish oil in your diet. You'll go a long way to living a very healthy and long life.
Well, you know, you've written a book called The Iron Time Bomb. Why don't you just, because I think that really was quite a revelation. You know, we remember growing up, we always thought about Popeye and the spinach and the iron and how, of course, that was the key to health. But, of course, people have forgotten that, you know, 100, 200 years ago, one of the methods of treatment for disease was bleeding. What was bleeding all about? Well, it was to get rid of excessive iron. So do you want to just cover that briefly? Because I think that's something that most people are relatively unaware of.
In Bible times, this wasn't in the Bible, but it's part of Bible history in the sense in those times, even children had lots of marks on their arms because they bled them in order to when they got ill. And the observation was that people got well when they were bled. Well, that's where 80% of the iron is in your blood circulation. Iron feeds bacteria, viruses, funguses, and cancer cells. So if you limit the amount of iron, you limit the ability of those little things to grow, and therefore that was discovered centuries ago. And by the way, we're back to using bloodletting to treat Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, iron overload disease, certain types of heart disease, and so on. So even forms of cancer. So you can do all that today without, of course, bloodletting. You can do it with something called rice bran extract. That's bran like bran cereal. And it's called IP6, my book, The Iron Time Bomb's all about it. If you don't believe this totally, just think about it historically. As we grow, we need iron because we're growing and we need more red blood cells. Aging starts after we're fully grown and we start to rust thereafter. Men have no outlet for their iron and they die first. And I have twice the rates of diabetes, heart disease, and cancer and infections by the age of 40. Because they have double the iron levels of a woman. Why does a woman have lower iron levels? It's real obvious. We know women are pale, weak, tired, and anemic because they lose their iron once a month. It's God's protection. They're the baby carriers. And, of course, they have to have limited amounts of iron. Otherwise, they'll get disease and they won't be able to have the baby. So even though women are weak and tired and pale, they do have this special protection. And don't begin to really accelerate and age until, of course, menopause or they've had an early hysterectomy. So any full-grown male, any woman after hysterectomy or menopause needs to limit the amount of iron. None in their food supplements. Just get it out of your diet. Women in their fertile years may need an iron supplement now and then, and be careful not to take it every day. And I recommend a certain form of iron in my book, but in supplement form. So these are all wonderful things to learn. God said the life is in the blood, and that's certainly true in respect to iron and other issues. So learning to control iron, you know, we take the two most volatile molecules in our body, which is oxygen, which leads to oxidation or rusting, we call it, and iron. Those two are in the red blood cells. They're locked together in a red pigment, And believe it or not, God put them so they don't cause any trouble as long as they're locked up. But if they get unlocked, then they become trouble, and it's the free-roaming iron, what we call free iron, that can rust out our body, and you got to learn how to control it. Things in our diet do that. IP6 rice bran extract does that. You can get what we call chelation therapy in a bottle. For $30, you can chelate yourself of these excess minerals as well as heavy metals like mercury, lead, and cadmium, and do it all in 30 days for $30 instead of running to the alternative medicine doctor and doing it for $4,000. So these are all wonderful lessons in life, things to learn how to control the iron, and it's iron that will help you live longer. I'll even prove it from the Bible, because fasting, as we recall, Moses fasted for 40 days and then lived from, that was at age 80, and then lived another 40 years till 120. So what is fasting? Of course, it's limiting the amount of iron intake. That's what fasting does for it. In fact, everything that we do to remain healthy, vegetarian diets, limit the amount of iron, because meat has highly available iron, plant foods not as available iron. An aspirin a day causes a little loss of about a spoonful of blood, which then causes iron loss. And, of course, we say that, of course, aspirin is good for us. Well, again, it's controlling iron. Fasting does that. Calorie restriction does that. Diets. All the things that we know, exercise, we sweat and we lose a little bit of iron. Everything that we know that's healthy controls iron. If we drink green tea like the Asians do, that has little pigments in it and it binds the iron. Or we drink wine that has little pigments in it, it binds the iron. Every possible thing that we know as a health practice really controls iron. That's how oil of oregano works. That's how many of these other antibiotics work. So we need to learn how to control iron to live long and stay healthy.
All right, so the website is billsardi.com. And what's the website for the books?
The books is herenowbooks.com, or my website is billsardi.com or askbillsardi.com. Both of those work. Lots of free information there. The books are at herenowbooks.com. And, of course, we welcome anybody to go to these websites. Get as much free information as you can. I try to keep writing free reports up there so people can get them on cholesterol and all these other wonderful topics. And I'm working on one now that'll sort out all these issues for women trying to figure out in menopause what should they do now that they're not supposed to take the hormone replacement therapy. Should they take soy or should they try flax or what should they do? So there's some new developments there. We're going to sort that out and give out a new report here soon in about a week.
Well, one of the things that, of course, we're told is we shouldn't be drinking as much coffee as we are. And then, of course, we hear elsewhere that sometimes coffee will actually cut down the incidence of certain types of cancers. What's the answer?
Coffee has bioflavonoids, little pigments that, again, bind iron. And, of course, that controls it. We see less Parkinson's disease among people who drink coffee. Now, coffee's a stimulant. If you want to drink that hard, harsh, concentrated Turkish coffee, you're going to find your heart fluttering. And it's a stimulant, just like ephedra is a stimulant for the heart. And you're going to find that you're going to have heart flutters and so on. So you've got to be careful there. Also, coffee is a diuretic. It washes away nutrients. But if a good strong cup of coffee in the morning, if we'll limit it to one and make it filtered coffee and so on, why, we'll probably do okay. It's a wonderful herbal supplement to get the brain going, and it probably is going to protect us from Alzheimer's disease. So.
Well, that's how I get started every morning. Anyway, Bill, we're out of time. Okay. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners before we let you go?
Well, certainly support Radio Liberty and put your faith in God. All these doomsday things, they sound terrible. I think we just have to rely on God. People in the past didn't have all the wonderful things we have in our modern era in life, and they prevailed, and they were tougher than we are. I think we've gotten weaker morally and spiritually, so we need to toughen ourselves, and that means practicing our muscles in the spiritual realm and, of course, to utilize those, and, of course, keep listening to Radio Liberty and make sure it stays on the air.
God bless you. Thanks so much. Good night, Bill.
You bet.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Bill Sardi, and we always enjoy having Bill on as a guest. And this is the time, of course, when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our program regularly to help us. And if you believe in what we're doing, if you believe we're really involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, economic battlefield. Why, we hope that many of you will decide you're going to join the Radio Liberty family, and you do that by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers, because they should be leading this spiritual battle. We ask you to pray for revival, because if the American people don't turn back to God, do you really think that God will ever bless this country again? And then finally, we ask you to remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be with you once again at this time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, if you're out across America, why, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us on the line a very special guest. One of my favorite guests is Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. It's been a couple of weeks since we've been together, and I've missed being on your show.
Well, we've missed having you. And did you get home safe?
I did. Just a brief respite, and I'll be going back to the Northwest. And the weather's beautiful this time of year, so I really enjoy it. But I do have significant consultation work up there.
All right, fine. Well, let's get into what's really going on today. And, of course, with our listeners, why Joel puts out the report on a weekly basis, and I get it by email. Always look forward to it. Always read it. Fascinating, fascinating material. So what's the report on this week? What do you think we ought to bring our listeners up to date on?
Well, I've been concentrating in the World Affairs Brief this week on various legal decisions handed down by the Supreme Court, which are going to have long-term, powerful negative effects on our society, almost akin to the Miranda ruling or Roe versus Wade, this new affirmative action ruling is going to have devastating results. I also want to talk about two primary jurisdictions which are starting to really use their power to take children away from family. That is, the dangers of going into a hospital and losing privileges of walking out with your children, and the danger of going into public schools and losing the privilege of walking out with the children, all over medical reasons. Should we go with that one first?
You've got the ball. You run with it.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Let's talk about this hospital situation. I had written in the World Affairs Brief a couple of years ago that there was the potential, because hospitals are carefully controlled with state licensure, that the hospitals would become, I predicted, yes men for state family services. And when it came, when there were opportunities, when the state did not like parental choice, vis-a-vis not liking immunizations or not wanting certain medical treatment that the state views as mandatory, they would use the leverage that they have over hospital licensing and administration to cause the hospitals to act as agents for the state in taking children away from parents. Now, a lot of people scoffed at that time, but it has happened. This past month, in Colorado, we had a young couple, and I don't know if you were aware of this, Dan, or if you've discussed this before on your show. It's the case of Baby M, just to protect the name of the family. It was a Colorado family who were basically against immunizations. They went into the hospital on an emergency pregnancy situation, and the hospitals, unbeknownst to the parents, routinely do all kinds of tests, which lay midwives or nurse midwives don't often do, because there are some danger. One of these tests is the hepatitis B test. The problem with in hepatitis B is a very dangerous, as you know, virus, but it is primarily found only in at-risk women, that is, that are involved in either the ghetto-type drug scene or homosexuality or other types of illicit relationships where cleanliness and this disease is transmitted. And unfortunately, sometimes this gets into the hospital system as well. But in any case, this family lived a very rural lifestyle. The doctor walked in and said, "You've tested positive for Hep B, and we're going to vaccinate your baby." And the father said, "No, you're not. I don't believe my wife has hepatitis B. And even if it did, we think that the vaccine, and there is good medical research showing that Hep B vaccine is very, very dangerous, always has pretty severe reactions with young children, and long-term side effects have been documented as well. But in any case, there was sufficient reason that the father did not want to have it. He knew that there was a 40 to 60% false positive reading on these tests, that it's not a very accurate test, very easy to get false positive readings. The second test came back positive. The father still was not convinced, and they convened a medical board. They called the state authorities, the family. They came in and threatened to take the child away from the family. In fact, the child was not in the custody of the family, having been in a hospital nursery where once you don't have the child, it's almost impossible to get the child back if they don't want to deliver it to you. But in any case, they literally threatened to take the child away over this issue of the vaccination. And they had four state policemen show up to enforce the state authority and the hospital decision that they would force the child to be vaccinated. And the child was forcibly vaccinated. He did go through a typical very, very adverse reaction. He did not die, but, there is no way of knowing yet whether there are going to be long-term side effects. Nevertheless, the third test, which the father demanded, came back negative. And the mother, in fact, has been tested again since and did not have Hep B, that it was, in fact, false positive. But the important thing that, and lesson to be learned here, is that as I had predicted, a lot of people don't realize it, but when you put yourself into a hospital situation, especially with a newborn baby that gets taken away into a nursery, because hospitals don't allow mothers to keep the baby with them, you lose custody, you lose physical custody, and if they don't like your medical choices, they can, in fact, and they did in this case, threaten to take away the child. And so it's a very dangerous situation. It's very much akin to public schooling, which we've warned about. And I think we've talked about this before in your show, the fact that with psychotropic drugs, where you have hyperactive children, school nurses prescribing even though they're not authorized as a doctor to do so, psychotropic drugs before a child can be readmitted to school. And when parents object, Division of Family Services many times gets involved and threatens to take away the rights of the parents and custody of the family if they do not subject their children to these mind-altering drugs. I think this is of great concern and something that is worthy of airing and discussing. Any comments from you as a doctor?
I'm just horrified that the doctor would say, well, if you... we're going to do it because we think we know what is best. Now, of course, he's not going to accept any responsibility. He can't be sued. The vaccine manufacturer can't be sued. And why are they so anxious to have immunity for the vaccine manufacturers if there's nothing to worry about? And
that's right.
I think the fact that they have got this legislation passed, so you have no recourse other than to try to sue the federal government, and lots of luck when you try to sue the federal government. So, I think, especially with hepatitis B, it is the most ridiculous vaccine because it is specifically a gene, and they've taken one gene, and unfortunately that gene is very, very similar to the gene in the myelin sheath. And so when you immunize people against that gene, the body of them wants to attack that gene, only they find it in your myelin sheath, and many people get demyelinating diseases similar to multiple sclerosis or peripheral neuritis. There is no vaccine other than maybe chickenpox, which is also a ridiculous vaccine to give, has the rate of adverse reactions that hepatitis B does. And to forcibly give that and not to say, well, let's get a third blood test and let's be absolutely certain. In fact, you would almost wonder if maybe the second test, whether it was or was not positive. Of course, I have a suspicious mind, but sometimes I think that in a hospital-administered situation, it can be very, very manipulative. And, of course, the parents lose their rights. And I agree with you. I think we should be very concerned about that and about putting our children any place where they can come under the control of Big Brother, who's always there to help. And yet, of course, we've seen the increase in autism from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 125 children, or 1 in 250 children, in some places 1 in 125. That's a frightening increase in a disease. And, of course, the public health officials say, we don't know why it's happening, but we know it's not related to vaccines. But we're going to take the thimerosal out of the vaccines anyway, just in case. I mean, what sort of insanity is that? Why have they put the thimerosal in if it wasn't safe? And if it is safe, why are they just saying, look, there's nothing wrong with it. Here are the scientific studies to show that the mercury we've been putting in for 30 years and the vaccines doesn't do any damage. So, they've in effect admitted that they've been poisoning our children. And, of course, who's responsible? Nobody. Because when you have a system that has no moral foundation, nobody's ever responsible for anything.
Well, of course, there is this. That's one of the problems with government exclusive licensing, is that you have a form of de facto immunity so that they can do no wrong as long as they're following standard protocols. And that's the problem with the medical profession. They are demanding that these protocols be followed because they can't be sued, and they have granted immunity, even if these protocols are deadly, as the vaccines are many times with young children, especially the DPT vaccine has been noted for, to be high relationship with sudden infant death syndrome and many, many adverse reactions. And yet it's amazing there is not a single doctor that has ever been called on the carpet for any purpose for having administered those vaccines. They have absolute complete immunity, and of course, as we know now, the vaccine manufacturers do as well. It's interesting to note the similarity here with the dental profession. For years and years, they've been mixing mercury in these amalgam fillings that they've been putting in and claiming that they're safe, and now it's known that they're not safe. And yet for tens of years, the medical profession in lockstep would continue to defend amalgam fillings and keep pumping mercury into people's bloodstream. It does leach out, and it does have a lot of effect from everything from dyslexia to other mental and slowdowns of the mind that have occurred. But most dentists are now admitting that. I think only about half of the dentists out there now would use amalgam fillings. A lot of them realize that even though the American Dental Association is still not admitting error there, that most dentists realize it's the wave of the future to stay away, and the porcelain fillings have come down in price. So I highly encourage anyone who's doing dental work, don't ever get another amalgam filling. It's very dangerous as well.
And I think really what's so interesting is the reason that they're having to do this, the dentists are having to change their pattern of treatment, is because of the Internet. And because the people are going on the Internet, they're finding that they've been lied to. And I will tell you that the American Dental Association is frightened to death to actually come out and tell the truth, because that, think of all the potential lawsuits there would be out there. And of course, there's a lawyer who's handling a class action suit against the American Dental Association, has offered to drop the suit if they would, at least against the California Medical Association, if they would just advise dentists not to continue putting in the fillings. And of course, they're afraid to do that. I mean, they are so determined, not to let the people know the truth, that they're going to hang on as long as they can. But, one thing I wanted to say about the doctor in Colorado, what he did, from a purely a medical point of view and customary practice, was entirely right. He would have been negligent not to advise them to, with a positive hepatitis B for the mother, not to advise them to give the child the hepatitis B shot. But at that point, it should have been up to the parent, not up to the doctor, to make the decision. In other words, did God give the child to the parents or to the doctor? If the parents say, no, we don't want this and we don't want you to do it, then it should be their decision rather than the doctor's decision. But that is where we get into trouble now, because the attitude is, well, the child doesn't really belong to the parent. They belong to the state, and we're here to make sure they get the best of care. But what happens if the patient ends up autistic or something?
Well, this is what I brought out in terms of the legal rationale. There is a very problematic legal doctrine that has been promulgated for many, many years in the United States, and it's called the compelling state interest doctrine. What it basically says, it posits a very benign idea, a benign-appearing idea, which says the state has an interest in the health, the safety, the welfare, the education of a child. The state has an interest. This sounds very, very nice. Everyone can nod and says, yeah, the state should have an interest. But you see, I don't care who has an interest in my child's welfare or my child's education. I want to know who has the ultimate interest. I want to know who has the ultimate authority when there's a disagreement over opinion. And that's where it breaks down. It isn't just a state interest doctrine. It is an ultimate state interest. The state is claiming the ultimate authority when there is a disagreement of opinion. And so whenever we run into this doctrine, it sounds very euphemistic, it sounds very benign, the state is simply trying to watch over and play mother bear to people, but in reality it is a denial of family sovereignty. Let me just point out one of the cases in education, of course. The state has an interest, it says, that all children get educated, and so therefore they claim to have the power to regulate homeschooling. And to the state interest, compelling state interest. I turned this around with the Oregon Department of Education when they challenged our homeschooling in the state of Oregon, and I said to them, I presume that because they wanted our children to have periodic tests, and I said, I presume if our children fail, one or more tests, that you'll require that they go into the public schools. Is that right? And they said, yes, that's right. May I also assume, then, if they fail tests in the public schools, that we get them back? And he said, oh, no, they have to stay in the public schools. And I said, wait a minute, if your interest is in the child and my school is failing and therefore you take them in and that school fails, then we have the right to put them somewhere else, don't we? And, of course, he would deny that. And I said, so what you're telling me is that your justification for this regulation is not state interest or simply for the benefit of the child. You simply are claiming the ultimate authority on who shall make decisions on education matters, and you're taking that away from the parent. And it really was proof. You can tell that, you can test that any time. If you're a homeschooling family, just ask your regulators, what happens if they fail a test in the public schools? Do I get to take the children out?
That makes a very, very good point. Well, anyway, I assume that came out on top on that argument.
Well, there was actually a legal test case. Oregon was the first one to try to regulate private schools and bring all private schools, make them all illegal and bring them under the state. So in Society of Sisters versus Oregon, it was the original Supreme Court decision that stated that Oregon had overstepped its bounds and that, in fact, it does not have the ultimate authority. So I had that legal case to go back upon. In other words, after the superintendent wanted to promote that argument that he had the ultimate authority, I threw out Society of Sisters to him, and he had to back down. So we did have the legal jurisdiction, but it's only because Oregon was the first state in the union to try to socialize all education. And right now, it's still one of the freer states of the union. Of course, as you know, in California is trying to close the loophole whereby homeschoolers are considered like a mini private school in California, and they want them all registered and regulated.
They want to dumb down the homeschooling children just like they've done with the state children, because they've done this intentionally and they've deliberately dumbed down the children. That's what's so unconscionable. And that, of course, is a message we've got to get out to the American people. At least I would hope they'd be concerned if they realized that was true.
So I have some in this latest World Affairs brief talking about the dangers of sovereignty in the hospital birth situation, as well as in public schools. I've given kind of a mini list of three or four ways to stay out of what I call dangerous jurisdictions. And that means public jurisdictions where they're going to claim higher sovereignty over your children than you as parents have. And those are hospitals and public schools. Those are very two dangerous institutions to go into. The first thing I recommend is that you do not sign on the dotted line on the form when you admit yourself into a hospital. If you read through that fine print, you'll find you lose all rights. You lose, the doctors have the right to tell you when you can come home, when to release you from custody. You really sign away from rights. If I were to go into the hospital, I'd draw a line through that entire form, and when I sign my name, I put a note and I say, I reserve all rights to approve all treatment and all medication specifically. No treatment shall be given me without my specific authorization. And that indicates to them that they don't have carte blanche. They can't take authority over you, and you can sign the same thing for your children. They won't like it, but in fact, you have the power to demand that, because hospitals are under kind of a quasi-government edict that they must treat anyone now. They can't turn anyone away, even if they can't pay. And so they can't turn you away if you refuse to sign their form.
That's an interesting thought. I hadn't even considered that. Okay. So I certainly agree with you that certainly as far as our children are concerned, we really want to be very, very concerned bringing them under the authorization, under the authority of the state or the hospital for that matter.
So one of the things that I suggested is act preventably to stay healthy so that you don't get, the medical insurance problem is a real trap in America. Because you get all this so-called free medical insurance the government forces upon employers to give to you, and even though it's you have very little rights to choose doctors or anything else if you're in an HMO system, nevertheless, the greatest trapping of it all is that it appears to be free to you. It really isn't insurance because, in fact, you use it for every little thing, and you're encouraged to use it for every little thing. But it's only good if you go through the establishment medical system, which is, of course, very much drug-oriented. And you know, as a medical doctor, the medical doctors get very, very little training in real preventative nutrition, hardly any training at all in herbs and any alternative practices. In fact, they're liable if they deviate from the drug therapy protocols, and that's why they recur to those. They won't be criticized if they do that. But when you use insurance, you are forced, if you want it free, to go through the establishment system. And so there's very little incentive for people to act preventively. There's very little incentive for people to learn how to cure themselves, how to do their own diagnosis, how to read up on alternative literature, and there's many, many things. And I speak from experience. My wife and I have learned these things over the years and have almost never entered the halls of the establishment medical system. I've learned to be healthy. We've had six children, almost all grown now, and none of them have ever been in a hospital situation. They've been mostly healthy, but all the other health problems we've had, we've been able to cure through finding the proper alternative remedies and living providentially and healthy. And I think there's some things that people can do. First of all, they've got to eat a low-sugar diet. a good balance between carbohydrates and proteins. You know, the zone diet talks about it's a little rigid, but there is the basic theory behind it is that there you really need a balance of carbohydrates and proteins so that you don't get diabetes and the highs and lows of blood sugar and other things that especially come from too much refined flour, refined sugars. Also, considering junk food that we should avoid, I think we ought to avoid food with a lot of chemical additives, the man-made fat substitutes, you know, this low cholesterol junk like margarine and the Cool Whip type toppings that are mostly shortening and other things. The sugar substitutes in soda pop I think are very, very damaging. There's a great deal of evidence now showing that some of these...
Nutrisweet aspartame is the aspartame product.
Yes, it's the aspartame. It's very, very damaging. And people just guzzle that stuff by the gallon, thinking that they're eating a healthier thing than sugar. And actually, the sugar's preferable to that, I believe, any day, even though I think that people ought to cut out the soda pop as well. I think people ought to, in a positive sense, eat lots of raw fruits and organic vegetables. That provides the live enzymes and vitamins and minerals. I think they ought to also cut way down on the quantity of food that they eat so they don't wear out glands prematurely. I think a lot of people suffer from worn-out thyroids, worn-out adrenal glands. A lot of that's because of stress, worn-out pancreas from overeating. I think it's been well documented that the excess of pancreatic enzymes does have an inhibiting effect on cancer cells. So when one's pancreas gets worn out over age and overeating, I think it's only natural that we become more vulnerable to cancer because of the lack of that natural remedy there. So I think it's important also to have a healthy dose of discipline with raising our children to make sure they eat properly. All too many parents I've seen eat properly themselves but don't have the courage to require that their children do as well. So we shouldn't be permissive about junk food with ourselves, and neither should we for our children.
All right, fine. Well, of course, then you won't get any argument from me on any of those issues. In fact, our last hour was certainly talking about health and nutrition. So
was it?
Right. Anyway, now what are some of the other issues you'd like to cover?
The last issue in terms of, before I leave this one, was that I wanted to have people realize that there is an alternative to hospital birth. At least in terms of the typical OB protocol, which is highly interventionist. First of all, the next step away from that is the certified nurse midwives who do birthing centers within hospitals. One has the safety of the hospital that is being near if there's an emergency, but you have a lot more labor and birth support that you virtually get none of with an OB. Very few OBs will show up until, you know, the baby's head is crowned. Certified nurse midwives will give good labor support throughout the entire process. They know a lot more about the natural procedures. The downside of certified nurse midwives, of course, are that they're not allowed to deliver in the home for mothers that are not at risk, who do not have high risk of birth. It's been fairly well documented that certified lay midwives who have 4 years of training and do home births also have a high, very, very high safety record. And I think that's a very viable alternative that may well be, as we see this hospital sovereignty issue loom greater and greater. I know a lot of the certified lay midwives feel very inspired, in fact, called into the profession. And there may well be a divine out there to help people someday from being caught in a system, especially for Christians, where I have predicted that one of the tests, the litmus test for getting your children out of custody out of the hospital is that you agree not to physically discipline or other types of things that may impinge upon one's Christian beliefs and abilities to teach and guide your children the way that they want to. The Lord may well be preparing this alternative system. But I think you have to be healthy. You have to make sure that you're not a high risk if you're going to go through the certified lay midwife route at home birth. Now, I realize this may be a little controversy relative to your training. Dr. Stan, have you got any comments about those suggestions?
Well, of course, the one thing you're always concerned about is there is a complication getting them to the hospital, because you don't have a lot of time. But, I mean, fortunately, most births really go pretty well. And
they do.
But
just
on that rare instance when, you know, there's a placenta previa or the cord is wrapped around the neck, and then you've got to be able to, of course, recognize the problem and get them in, and you don't have a lot of time. So, most births are, very, very natural. If they weren't, why most of us wouldn't be here. But on those rare instances, then you do need a skilled physician and intervention.
Yes, it's interesting, though, that because of the excessive monitoring and protocols, there is a much higher rate of cesarean section now, bordering on the totally unnecessary, almost because of fetal monitoring. A lot of stress does occur to the baby, and oftentimes that stress is used as an excuse to have a C-section when, in fact, it isn't necessary.
Well, unfortunately, the situation that we're in, Joel, is the fact that the doctor is very, very defensive. And if for any reason that child is not completely normal, why, he's going to get sued. In fact, and then, of course, they say, well, now this little baby is a year old. He's got paralysis. He's got 70 years ahead of him, and you're going to have to pay for their care for the next 70 years. And, of course, the child may or may not even live that long. But the doctor is in a situation now many times he is forced by the circumstances and the fear of litigation to do a cesarean section. Unfortunately, we're getting to a situation where more and more doctors are just giving up OB. They can't afford the $100,000 or $200,000 malpractice insurance. They can't really practice, with this feeling of looking over their shoulder all the time. We're creating a monster. We're going to have to take a quick break here. It's about a half hour. We'll be right back. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, give us a call at 833-24-LIBERTY. That's 833-24-LIBERTY. Or, of course, 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment, if you agree or disagree, well, I would love to hear from you. Our guest this evening, Joel Skousen, his publication, WorldNet Brief. Joel, would you like to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you?
Yes, the World Affairs Brief is outlined on my website, which is www.joelskousen.com. Lots of things on my website. I usually feature a hot issue every month, as well as I have a long-term strategic issue. One of the major banners that people should be interested in is what's called Strategic Threats of the Coming Decade, where I analyze the major predator nations, Russia and China, and what they're planning and doing in terms of striking the United States, as well as our own globalist-oriented leaders and what they're trying to do in terms of engender hate and discontent against America leading to World War III. That's under a blue banner on my website called Strategic Threats. You'll also find on my website items about law and government, about how to reestablish liberty and tighten up the language of the Constitution so that the Supreme Court, as we're going to shortly discuss, can't weave their magic with the loose language of our founding fathers. Lots of interesting stuff. And if you don't have access to the web, you can call my office at area code 801-224-4746, and I'll be happy to send you out sample print edition copies of the World Affairs Brief.
Give that telephone number one more time.
Area code 801-224-4746.
All right, fine. So I recommend the World Affairs Brief to you. It always has something fascinating in it. And then I'm very interested now in knowing your response to this ridiculous decision by the Supreme Court, reversing a decision made 10 or 15 years ago. What's changed since then? Nothing, except now they think they can get away with it. They didn't think they could get away with it then. And you have to admit, you have to understand that we have people on the Supreme Court who don't believe in the Constitution, because there is nothing in the Constitution that allows the Supreme Court to say anything about homosexuality or how it is regulated or what's fair or what's not fair or the important thing is that the Supreme Court was only to deal with matters between the states. It had nothing to do with individuals. Matters dealing with life, liberty, and property were to be taken care of by the states, and all powers not specifically herein given to Congress or limited to it by the states are to be reserved to the states and to the people. That's what America was all about. It was about limited federal government. And, of course, as you move from a republic to a democracy, and, of course, whatever men want to do, they can, or men and Sandra Day O'Connor. And you have people on the Supreme Court who have a political agenda. They're not interpreting the law. They go with how they feel about issues. And that's really so frightening. We've gotten away from rule by law to rule by men.
Yes, absolutely. It's interesting that both of these major decisions, one the overturning of the Texas sodomy law, was not, even though certain of the normal libertarian arguments were reached in or talked about in that case, the case was decided on the issue of the right to privacy, much as Roe versus Wade was, of which there is no actual right to privacy in the Constitution. One of the most disturbing defenses, though, which was problematic, was that the conservative side of the court was saying, you know, there's no right to be a homosexual outlined in the Constitution. Therefore, it's okay for the states to outlaw it. The problem with that doctrine is that the Constitution never did delineate a bona fide definition of what was a fundamental right. It never did intend to be all-inclusive of listing what are the rights. So I'm very reluctant to defend, you know, the Texas statute as Justice Thomas did and Justice Rehnquist based upon the concept that there's no right listed in the Constitution. If we were to say there's no right listed in the Constitution, we would be denied most of our other rights. I think we have to be very careful to understand that the U.S. Constitution went out of its way not to list rights, and that's one of the main reasons why the Anti-Federalists didn't want the Bill of Rights. They felt like it would be used in this particular way of saying if we didn't list a right that it could be denied to us. Now, the Federalists correctly made the point of view, no, our government is very limited. It's all the other rights are reserved to the people. And unfortunately, of course, it said reserved either to the states or to the people, and the states took the rest and left nothing to the individual. So it's a problem, and I address this in my system of law and government on my website, where I give an actual viable definition of what constitutes a fundamental right. And it is this. A fundamental right is a right that everybody can simultaneously claim without forcing other people to serve their needs. Let me repeat that. A fundamental right is a right that everyone can simultaneously claim without forcing anyone to serve their needs. Now, with that simple definition, you can cut the difference between the false right to an education, the false right to a job, the false right to free medical care, because everybody can't claim an education without forcing somebody to serve their needs. Somebody's got to build the school. Somebody's got to teach school. Somebody's got to be forced to provide, you know, the textbooks. So you can't all claim something. You can't all claim the right to an education. You can't claim the right to free medical care without forcing someone to be the doctors and the nurses to serve your needs. But you can all claim your right to life. You can all claim the right to contract. You can all claim the right to associate with who you want to associate. You can claim the right to ownership of property dutifully earned by the value of your own labor without coercion to other people.
Well, but if we were going to use that definition, Joel, wouldn't people have a right to be a homosexual if they wanted to be a homosexual?
Yes, in fact, they would. This is a case where it's in violation of God's law.
And that is the key that I was hoping you're going to get around to, because our rights do not come from government. In America, different than any other country in all recorded time, our rights came from God. And, of course, the laws of the United States for over 100 years after the Constitution was established were based upon Blackstone's commentaries of the laws of England, which was based upon God's law, but based upon the Holy Scriptures. And, of course, that was the basis of our freedom, was, of course, God's law.
There is a slight difference, though. There are many. There are certain things that God reserves for His judgment, because of the fact that this earth is a testing element, and it's very clearly a testing element because the judgment is reserved for after this earth life. He does give certain consequences, but not for everything and not immediately. In other words, there's delayed consequences often because the Lord is paying out rope. He's letting people be tested to see how they respond to the promptings of conscience, to see how they respond to the Holy Spirit, to see how they respond to the Word of God and to people who preach the Word of God. And that's one of the interesting things that we must analyze, is that in the Old Testament, for example, we had what was called a religious covenant society. The people of the Lord had made a covenant to live God's law, and that was, you'll notice that it wasn't mandated outside, except, and it's very interesting, when you look at the relationship between the children of the house of Israel, having covenanted to obey the higher commandments, and even had death penalties for homosexuality or for adultery and other things, the stoning and the eye for an eye if retribution wasn't given, many, many higher laws. But we must not assume that he was allowing the state to exercise the same authority. Only religious judges, I think, are worthy of judging some of the moral laws of God. On a secular state basis, the Lord tends to have established the system, as in our Constitution, whereby if you violate someone's fundamental rights, then the state can intervene. But some of those moral laws that are violated of God don't necessarily violate someone's fundamental rights. And we're talking about consensual evil here. Consensual evil isn't a violation of anyone's fundamental rights, but it is a violation of God's law. And one of the problems with allowing the state, and this is a very important point, with allowing the state to enforce God's law is, first of all, there's a fair amount of difference of opinion of interpretation of God's law. You know, there's the Gary North and the Reconstructionists who want to go back to the stoning of certain people, and there are many other, you know, equally committed Christians who wouldn't go into that. They wouldn't go into the law of Moses and the various other things. So there is some problem in allowing the state to enforce God's law in terms of these permissive areas where there is no violation of fundamental rights, but there is a violation of the moral code of God. The second problem involved is the generalization of law. That is, if we give the state the power to enforce moral decisions that are not violations of fundamental rights, then if the state by majority will becomes Marxist, then we have to allow them to justify persecuting Christians. In other words, if they switch to an evil moral thing, by the same token you said, well, you know, as long as the majority was Christian, you gave them the power to enforce your Christian form. Now the majority is Marxist and we have to give them the power to enforce you know, Marxism. So the only safe way, as I posited in my system of law and government, is to make sure the state can only enforce the violation of fundamental rights. And in terms of and we leave the judgment of God to punish those who violate the moral ones that are not violent, that are consensual, but moral. We allow God, and He will judge them, and He will condemn them for that. The state can intervene then in one or two circumstances. That is, in the case where there's imminent threat, for example, that's where it is justified to intervene in drunk driving, because there's an imminent threat to the violation of fundamental rights, imminent threat to life when a drunk driver is going down the road. When we talk about homosexuality, I think when they cross that line and they start to use coercion or enticement inside the family contract, they try to entice young people, I think through family sovereignty law, we could establish a form of law which doesn't allow any enticement at all inside the family contract, either of a wife out of adult to make her an adultery. I think there could be a violation of contract. So there are ways to handle this without expanding on the state's ability to go in and enforce moral consensual issues, because as I say, there's a danger there in the sense if the state majority becomes Marxist, they can enforce anti-Christian laws with the same power of authority as we allow them to enforce Christian morals.
Now, of course, you and I would know that the Marxist is not justified and the Christian is, but then again, there is this difference of some pretty strong differences of opinion and interpretation in Christian doctrine, and I'm not sure you or I would be comfortable with certain Christians the way that they would enforce things. It's a tough subject, Stan. I'm sure you've got some comments.
Well, I think that I think that this was really a watershed event. First of all, I don't think that the homosexuality has any place in the federal government. I do not believe that they should have a right to say it's right. They don't think they should have a right to say it's wrong, in the same way that they should have nothing to say at all about abortion. I believe that matters dealing with life, liberty, and property should be left at the state, or preferably even at the local level. And in fact, I would think if a local community wanted to say, you know, homosexuality would be considered a crime, fine. If they said it would not be considered a crime, that would be their decision. I believe that the best way to remain free is to have things regulated at the local level rather than the state or the national level, because it's much harder to regulate, you know, 1,000 different communities or 10,000 different communities than one centralized authority like the Supreme Court. But be that as it may, you know, ignoring that, my major concern is that there's no incidence in all history where a nation has embraced homosexuality where that nation has survived. And, of course, you read the history of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and we're headed exactly the same way. Because, of course, people look at this saying, well, what's fair, what's not fair? But I think, of course, that God judges nations just as he judges individuals, but he judges individuals in the next life. In this life, he judges nations. And I really believe that we're going to see God's judgment on America in the not-too-distant future. And what you're looking for is a logical, humanitarian, right way of looking at this issue and how can it be handled. And, of course, my would take the next step. And I say that, you know, certainly I do not feel that the federal government has any business in this one way or the other. But even more important, that I think that the American people have to understand that I think that this was an affront to God. And if you keep defying God, why, one of these days, he's going to completely withdraw his protection from this nation. And we live in a very uncertain world. We live in a world where people hate America. And they hate Americans because of what we're doing, because of our policies, because of our exploitation. And, of course, the Chinese communists, I believe, really want to rule the world. I think that the Russian communists want to rule the world. And, of course, I think that God may very well use them as he did, 2,500 years ago, use the Assyrians to punish his children of Israel. So I think that God will use others to punish us. So looking at this thing from a logical point of view, you're absolutely right. Looking from God's point of view and looking at it from a spiritual point of view, I tremble for my country.
Well, I can't help but agree with you there, Stan. When you look at the jubilation of the homosexual community over this, they know what they've won here. They know that they now have a drumbeat that they can use the legal authority of this law, and that no one will have the power to stand up against their agenda now. And that's what's going to move forward. I believe firmly that probably the final moral litmus test that every nation fails before it goes into destruction is it gets close to a majority entering into homosexual conduct. And when that happens, I think the hand of protection of the Lord fails a nation. Even though I think that the Lord allows a lot of rope for people to hang themselves, that's why he allows people to seemingly get away with this kind of gross immoral behavior. And I think he himself allows a good deal of it to happen without immediate judgment. I think we have to admit that. So he does have an interest in allowing these tests to occur, but this does not mean that he will be infinitely patient, that he will not withhold judgment. And I think the time when this ripe plum rots and falls from the tree, that there is a massive retribution that will come upon this nation, and the major litmus test has been immorality and then going to homosexuality is the one that rings the death knell of the nation.
You know, one of the most interesting things, as I begin looking at some of our leaders, some of the people in key positions in our society, for instance, Forbes, not Steve Forbes, but his father was a homosexual. And I find as I talk to people who, in the know in Washington, D.C., how many key people in both political parties really are homosexual. Is it simply by coincidence that David Rockefeller has now gone onto the board of a Republican organization? I've forgotten the exact name of it, but it's a pro-homosexual Republican organization. Why would David Rockefeller at this time of his life join something like that? Why would many of the people within the Republican Party here in California, the liberal wing of this, embrace this homosexual agenda and want to bring homosexuals into key positions in the party? You know, in fact, why would our president appoint homosexuals to so many key positions in his administration? I think that, of course, anybody has only to look and see what's happening and realize that we're in real trouble. Hillary, I have a video that was shot in Washington, D.C. when Bill Clinton and became the president. There was, of course, he allowed all of these gay and lesbian parties during the inauguration celebration. And there were literally tens of thousands of homosexuals there in Washington, D.C. celebrating that their man was in the White House. And I have a video. It was shot by a friend of mine. And of course, there's a lesbian up before this crowd of 10,000 cheering homosexuals and lesbians saying, well, I have it on reliable sources that the First Lady had an affair with one of us while she was in college, referring to Hillary Clinton. We're in real trouble as a nation. Hillary may be our next president.
You know, one of the major problems we face is that I think one of the greatest defenses against homosexuality is the right of people to express openly that I disagree, I don't want to participate, I don't want to accept your invitation, I'm offended by it. And now, because of political correctness and the threat of lawsuits and of discrimination, people have to remain silent about their opposition to it. And even Christian ministers are being prosecuted in Europe and in England for preaching at the pulpit that homosexuality is a sin. So I think when you curtail the voice of opposition and the voice of rejection, then a great many people fall into the trap and feel like by where silence is assent and that no one's speaking out against it and everyone's saying nice things about homosexuals, I think it has a great deal of effect against the children who are not being raised proactively by their parents to understand the great evil here.
And I think the other thing is, I mean, as individuals, you know, many homosexuals are really very charming, very nice, very kind, and very considerate people. But if you care about them as human beings, you're going to tell them what you're doing is wrong, and you're going to bring God's wrath on yourself, and you're eventually going to be destroyed. You know, one of the things that, and I'm writing my newsletter, and I don't know whether I'll have time to put it in this month, maybe it'll be next month, but something I found out, and I really never wanted to talk about this, because I didn't want to accept it as real, but I know it is. Back in 1988, I guess it was, a friend of mine and I were invited to go back to Washington, D.C. by Congressman William Dannemeyer to testify before a congressional committee on the AIDS epidemic. And my friend made arrangements to actually get an invitation to go to the White House to talk to some of the president's advisors. And he sat down and talked to this man who was advising President Reagan on the AIDS epidemic. And, of course, the shocking thing to me, and the reason I really didn't even want to think about it, although I'm sure it's true, is that the decision was made early in the epidemic not to do anything about this deadly disease because it involved primarily homosexuals and IV drug users, in other words, the undesirable elements of society. And so until 1987, the president did not once mention the word AIDS. And then in 1987, I think he realized, of course, the seriousness of the epidemic. He did give a speech advocating an effective public health policy and why the staff there refused to carry out his dictates. So there really were people who wanted to see homosexuals die. Over a quarter of a million homosexuals in the United States have died of AIDS, and millions more are going to die here in the United States of AIDS. And, of course, you know, There are evil people out there, and of course, whether this is their dictates, I'm sure that this is what they wanted. But of course, the average homosexual can't understand that. He thinks he's winning, and the truth is, he is going to be destroyed in this, along with the rest of us.
You know, a lot of people don't understand, I think, that it's much like alcoholism. People work overtime when they're strong or heavy drinkers to try to make sure that it doesn't affect the rest of their life, to try to make the case in their own mind, perhaps, as well as to other people, that I can isolate this and it doesn't have to affect my judgment and other things, but it does. Eventually, because there is such a gross violation of conscience involved in demeaning your body through smoking or through drinking or through immoral behavior, whether it's heterosexual or even homosexual, all of that is a gross violation of the voice of conscience. And the Lord penalizes one's ability to hear the positive voice of conscience, and they do make more mistakes over time. It may not happen until they're in middle or older age, but they do make major mistakes, and I've very rarely seen anyone who engages in gross violations of conscience that is able to maintain this balancing wire act of appearing normal throughout their life. They do, it does show up, and there are consequences.
Yeah, well, the consequences to everything we do, and I think that's what most, or certainly most people want to acknowledge, but specifically homosexuals don't want to acknowledge. Of course, in one of the big fallacies, you know, many of the people were raised in Christian homes, and they were told, once saved, always saved, you've got nothing to worry about. You know, God will forgive your sin because he's a forgiving God. And, of course, I don't think God's going to forgive their sins. And I don't believe that if you are really saved, you're going to be carrying on an existence like that if you really believe in our Lord. So I really feel so sorry. I believe that they've had a lot of false doctrine. And I think that there's going to be, as the phrase, if you'll excuse it, the hell to pay down the line for what these people are doing today. And
you know, that's,
but we have to, you know, we have to speak out and say what you're doing is wrong. Don't you understand, you know, what it's doing as far as your body is concerned, as far as your health is concerned, as far as eternity is concerned? And that's what nobody wants to say.
Yes, it's true. You've said it very, very well, Dr. Stan.
Well, anyway, I'm concerned about this decision, and I certainly sympathize with your position. I know where you're trying to come from. But trying to look at this thing from a completely fair point of view, there's nothing fair about God's laws. This is the way it is, and we either accept it or reject it. But,
well, the only difference is whether or not the state should have the power to enforce all of God's laws.
Right.
Because the state's not a good judge of those things. It doesn't have the moral character. It doesn't have the wisdom and God's training that comes and has to be based upon righteousness and righteous living, and certainly our judges don't qualify for that. So there is a problem there, and I don't say I have all the answers there, but I know that you know, we're heading into a point where they're going to begin to enforce evil versions of morality upon Christians, and Christians are going to become persecuted, and it is going to be based upon same so-called rights that they said, well, you did it when you were in charge of the government, now we're in charge of the government. So I'm kind of hedging my bet there and saying, all right, nobody's going to enforce you know, their own moral view against consensual acts, only against fundamental rights. And believe me, if you look at my definition of fundamental, it covers 90% of everything that really is damaging in society. And it's true, though, that if you do allow an open drug society and an open homosexual society, unfortunately, it does start to contaminate the rest of society. There's never been one that hasn't gone eventually into major corruption, especially when you don't have the right to form protective covenant societies. And that's one of the problems in our own legal system in the United States, is without the right of secession, without the right of, you know, you don't have the right to form your own free Christian community where you can enforce by mutual consent God's laws. And that's really what I think the Old Testament covenant society was. By mutual consent, they all agreed by covenant with God that they would all agree with these consequences. Now, that's different than majoritarian society of where you have majority rule. We aren't the majority anywhere now, and we don't have the right even, you can't even form your own city government within a state compact and say, we're going to enforce God's law in this city. They won't allow you to do it, and you should be able to do it. It's the only defense, I think, against a growing corruption across society, is the ability to form covenant societies whereby you can have your own higher levels of law than what the majority around you wants.
Well, then, of course, the people who don't want to go along with that sort of law can just pick up and leave the community.
That's the way it should be.
To do that, but of course we don't, and we will not. Unfortunately, it's a theoretical consideration. The reality is we have a corrupt Supreme Court that has a political agenda and is moving to destroy what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave by massive expansion of federal power over every aspect of our lives. Joel, we're out of time. Once again, the website where people can get in touch with you?
www.joelskousen.com. It's spelled J-O-E-L-S-K-O-U-S-E-N.
And the telephone number?
801-224-4746.
Good night. God bless you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Joel. And, of course, we ask for your prayers for Radio Liberty, for our provision, and for our protection, and for the homosexuals out there, that at least some of them will understand that we really do care about them. And the best thing we can do is say, what you're doing is in violation of God's law. Good night. God bless.